consequently come to be regarded as the perfect evidence of the power of mind over matter. It is the perfect proof that constructive thought can make us rich. But are we going to be constructive rich? Or are we gaining this wealth by the compromise of constructiveness? The moral value of the mind is of the greatest importance. What is it doing? What is it? Is it a relentless power instrument? Is it just a vast technical computer? Is it something that is soulless and purposeless and only gives us the facts to do with as we please? Or does the mind explain a little to us why things happen and why we can make different things happen in our own lives if we really want to? Is the mind serving us? Is the mind helping us to grow, or is it simply helping us to be lazy? Does the mind mean that we are making better use of our talents, or simply getting more for them and making no good use at all? Is the mind giving us success in the terms of real estate and stocks and bonds, which incidentally can be wiped out very quickly in spite of mental ingenuity, or more usually because someone else's mind is smarter than ours? This is all part of a great delusion. And yet with this delusion, we try to live. So with a mind that won't tell us the truth, or we don't expect it to, or won't let it tell us the truth, a set of emotional factors that will not permit us to be happy, cheerful, pleasant people, a vital system that is so diluted and degenerated by our upper conduct that we are tired all the time, and finally a body that might be well expected to hold on for quite a while that becomes a wreck in 50 or 60 years. Now this is the pattern against which the ages put up the pattern of human growth. Everywhere we look, we see that nature is insisting upon improvement. Nature will not sustain that which is not growing. Nature will not tolerate forever that which is contrary to the common good. If we want to be successful people, we'd better get started copying the way nature does it and not expect to have some strange abnormality make us satisfied and happy. Now, we come to another factor, then, that is the fifth factor. We can call it what we want to. The Buddhist calls it buddhi, or the bodhi of the upper intelligence. It has sometimes been called the divine mind. It has been called the upper mind, the psychic mind, the soul mind. And perhaps the soul mind is about as good as anything we can find to call it. This is the sensor. This is the power of the soul, which can never rest while the organisms are corrupt. The soul is that which is a small, silent voice, but it's there forever. It is something that finally forces us to recognize that we are not doing what we ourselves really want to do, that we are buried in the confusion of our own ambitions. So the problem of the soul becomes something that is higher than mind. The soul deals in finalities. The soul can ask the individual the simple question, what is all adding up to? All the things we do, are they all ending in the graveyard? Is materiality an acceptable attitude? The mind, under certain conditions, particularly if it moves in a sophisticated set, will say, yes, I can be an atheist. I don't necessarily believe in anything, because if I believe in something, I'm apt to have some of my ambitions curtailed. If I believe in God, I cannot do these things which are disobedient to every record we have of divinity, therefore let's eliminate divinity. They believe this. They say that the universe is what we make it every day, nothing more, nothing less. It's a machine, and it's a kind of a computer that apparently makes as many mistakes as our new computers make, and that's numerous. But the universe is not a computer. The universe is a mass of obvious intelligence. It is the most supreme example of a wisdom beyond comprehension by man. The universe is a tremendous living organism which, in spite of anything we believe or do not believe, is always right. We cannot break its rules. They are bigger than we will ever be. We have to live within it. Therefore, the psychic part of man, the soul, says very simply, what is a man worth when he has lost all his worldly goods? Answer, he is worth exactly what he was before. The entire problem of success as we know it, within very moderate and normal conscientious details, may be necessary to our survival here. A reasonable amount of endeavor, a useful and fulfilling career if possible, an honest day's work honestly done, no one doubts or questions. The question is, to what degree are we using these instruments that have been given to us simply to add to something that adds to nothing? How are we going to do, what are we going to do about the yacht and the Bahamas when we aren't here anymore? And how long will it be? Many individuals seem to act as though they were going to live forever, and then mistakes cut them down, mistakes of their own making. So why should we destroy our integrity, corrupt our families, destroy our civilizations, impoverish humanity, leave half the earth starving to death, in order that a few, or even more than a few, can do something very important now, like amassing a great fortune? What is it all about? Before the individual can hope to go on to the esoteric worlds of thought, he's got to think these things through. He's got to come to the final conclusion that he must clean the inside of his own cup. He must see that his own life is, as far as is humanly possible, brought under moderation, under a conscientious use of what he has, and a continuous dedication to the service of his fellow men. These are the things which, to the gurus of old, were the indispensable values. Now, the Indian gurus who had their disciples have become a legendary kind of group. They were persons who became the spiritual parents of young people to give them a training or an insight or an understanding. Very often, the young people went and lived in the ashram or in some hermitage where the guru lived. They lived a very simple life. They lived a very quiet life. And they lived constantly in the presence of a person who was beyond the temptations of mortal life. The guru was a living embodiment of the teachings that they hoped to come to. The guru had no material possessions. All his worldly goods was a lota, a bowl which was to be his begging bowl. He had a few little strips of cloth, a bead or two around his neck, a dhoti around his waist. This was all the material possessions he had. He lived only to help and educate and enlighten his disciples. Therefore, for these young people who lived with him for 5 or 10 years, day or night and night, he became a living example of being exactly what he taught. Now, this is very important. He gave the example of no exploitation. He offered nothing to the disciple except the right to grow. He offered no satisfaction, no end to personal problems, but only a quietude which would cause these problems to solve themselves. The guru is a living example of what is accomplished by simply being in the world but not of it. And the disciples who came to him became teachers in their turn. They were there in order to learn to become servants of human need. There was never any discussion of great establishments. The great work was the simple work of living true to principle and bestowing this vital experience to others who came after. Now, it's hard to do this in our modern civilization. We know that. because the old days are not with us very much anymore. And young people gathering for various religious purposes have not the background. These two students that came to the gurus came from families that had religious domination in thought and philosophy for maybe 50 generations. We have nothing like that today. We have no way of classifying or finding out just how to judge the validity of various paths that seem to open. But we can do something. We are not powerless to make certain decisions that are really useful to us. One of these decisions is that we can be slow to become involved in an organization or in a teaching which we know nothing about. We have the right to observe. And those who desire to join an organization must not and should not be over-influenced by promotional material or things of this nature. The individual who is wise in these matters will do well to observe this group of people very carefully and probably hold decision for at least 1 year. If during that year they have evidence of the integrity of those people, the dedications that they have to the higher principles of life, that they are free from ulterior motives and they are free from emotional combativeness, they are neither worriers, nor fearers, nor hopers, but they are workers. If in the end of a year it proves conclusively that this group is getting along well together, that kindness has been born among them, that friendship is their common term, and that they are dedicated to a purpose that is commendable, at the end of a year of observation, the individual may feel that he can decide wisely whether or not this particular group is for him. The same type of thing occurs in connection with individual teachers. They should be observed. Their motives should be analyzed. The individual should try to get over his terrific pressure to get spiritual quick and find out whether there is any substance in the matter under consideration. He must try to gradually get away from all inducements that are offered to him that are not part of the integrities of universal truth. That he is being invited maybe too strenuously, that he is not ready for what is being offered to him, or that those who are offering it do not have a proper dedication on their own parts, that there is not a true recognition of the fact that the entire course of spiritual growth is the long, quiet journey home, as Plotinus called it. It is the trip back to the source of ourselves, to the great foundations and integrities that were made flesh and dwelt in us. Therefore, our entire purpose is to grow, and by growth, to serve. And this gives us one more final attitude about the matter. And that is, what do we expect to be if we grow? If we achieve the enlightenment that is promised, if we attain to the tremendous internal vision that we would like to have, what are we going to do? What is our use going to be? Are we going to use wisdom largely to keep our own contentments? Are we going to use this wisdom to get away from all troubles, difficulties, labors, and worries? Are we going to use this to become superior to other people? Is it going to glorify us and gratify us to know that we have achieved? All these attitudes are for the most part wrong. The answer lies again that the only reason that we can really want to grow rightly is that we may become instruments of the attainment of universal growth for all that lives. In other words, we become servants of something higher no matter how high we go. Until finally we are the servant of truth itself. And until then, the journey isn't over. And when we are servants of truth, we are in slavery to reality. There is nothing beyond that we can go. And yet that slavery is a strange kind of complete freedom, because with it is the recognition of the integrities we seek and the perfect acceptance of a divine state for which we were originally intended. But egoism must go. All of the ulterior motives. The individual must not follow these lines in order to be prosperous or in order to reconcile some inconsistency of his own mind. He cannot possibly have any other motive except a sincere 100% dedication to the achievement of union with the reality of which he is an inevitable part. Until he does this and takes this attitude, he is not safe in his search for spiritual values. Now, we have troubles also in the world religions today. What we cannot realize, really, mostly, is that there is one God, although he has 72 names. The names have become important. Today we have a great rise of terrorism in the name of the true God, the God of love and the God of peace. Suddenly becomes a justification for hatred and for everything of this nature. Now we have to be extremely careful in our own lives when we come to recognize our own religious allegiances. If we are in an allegiance to a competitive organization, one that is out to dominate and discredit others, then we either have to join that movement of aggressiveness or else we have to resign our membership. We must therefore try desperately and definitely not to be taken into various creedal and denominational factors. All denominations and all creeds have their place. They are right. They are on one of the rungs of the ladder. But not one of these creeds can prevent us from gradually coming to the realization that truth is one, that unity is the absolute and actual reality, and that all denominations are merely facets of one terrific spiritual reality. Therefore, in serving God, we love all. In serving ourselves, we sacrifice others to our own ambitions, our own purposes, and our own prejudices. On the level of prejudices, which become, in a sense, mental blocks, we find it very easy to have prejudice against various beliefs. But we go back to the Inquisition, we go back to all of the great tyrannies of the past to find out what prejudice does. A prejudice of any kind does nothing but hurt. And instead of that, each person must strive definitely and in every way that he can to overcome all prejudice on levels of religion or philosophy. He may choose his own path, but he should not discredit the path of anyone else. It is their right to do as they please, but not necessary that he conform with it. So each person gradually becomes, in a sense, alone. But the Chinese had a very interesting point of view on this particular point. They had a sacred land, which is not our Eden or our heaven or paradise. But strangely enough, they had a word for it that we have used for many years for something else. The heaven of the Taoist sages of China is called Horizon, from which our word horizon comes. And this is a land in which all the wise and the loving get together. And they go in little ships, their own souls, to this great and beautiful garden world. In this garden world, there is no punishment, no evil, no purgatories, only the poets and the scholars and the friends and the mothers and the children and the fathers sit under the trees and enjoy life. And, strangely enough, it is probably one of the few post-mortal state in which everyone is still studying. Those who have passed on are also learning a little something new every day. Life is not static. It's not assumed that the average person can play a harp successfully. Therefore, it's not suggested. Life becomes an adventure in knowledge, an adventure in friendship, in art, and music, and kindness. And here come the tired and the weary who have done it as best they could and have really tried hard. And they are welcomed into the assembly of the ones who have gone there and have done the thing right. All those in that world there have fulfilled the requirements. They have lost all sense of personal ambition. They are not even ambitious to be there. This is another point. But they are there because when they woke up after death, there they were. But there they were because of the way they had lived before death. They just couldn't help but wake up in a pleasant place because they had devoted their lives to service of others, love and kindness. There was no problem of sectarianism there. Anyone could believe anything he wanted to, because if he wasn't right, he couldn't get there in the first place. But being right did not mean he necessarily agreed with everyone completely. He had his own values and his own interpretations. Therefore, there could be some wonderful discussions and conversations, and the various members could get together in little groups and discuss the eternal values of things. It is said that Lao Tzu went there on the back of his water ox, when the mortal world of China no longer would accept him. So everywhere in this philosophy of ideas, there is a reward, and whether it is horizon, the land beyond, or simply that which is beyond our horizon at the moment, we are all working towards one thing. We are working towards happiness, friendship, kindness, and love. We are working for a better place for our children and their children. We want to have happiness for them, because only in the happiness of others can our own happiness be established. We want to live straight and square and fair. And we would rather live very humbly than compromise the principles which are the basis of life. So under those conditions, the person can attempt to enter the path of wisdom. He can find the way of teachers, the way of knowing what to do. But in each case, the teachers come only when the individual or the disciple attains a certain level. If the person completely controls the physical body and its various functions, there will in due time appear the teacher to tell him what to do next. As the Hermetic axiom of Egypt was, when the disciple is ready, the teacher is there. But the teacher, if you can't go out and find him before you're ready, and there's no use trying. And when you're ready, there's nothing you can do, because you will find that which is next comes to you. Only, however, if you have kept the rules, kept the life, kept the values, and kept the integrities. So there is no need to worry about rewards or anything of that kind. The reward of growth is growth. The reward of individual integrity is to build a better world for everyone else and a happier life for yourself. There are integrities in life, and way back in the period of the god Nebo, in the ancient Babylonian and Chaldean tablets, there is a very simple type of instruction for man which he has never outgrown. One says, when a man builds a house, he shall use good materials and shall cheat in nothing. And if he does cheat, he shall be penalized. An individual who sells something will be punished by God if what he sells is not of the quality represented. Now, this was 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. But no matter what we do or how hard we try, we will never make those thoughts untrue. They cannot be changed. And if you don't believe that, watch what's happening today and see how everything is being shotted and nobody is happy about anything. The integrities are the basis of spiritual growth. And the life and the race and the people who have achieved integrity will have no problems to worry about here or in times to come. So don't worry too much. If you're interested in finding out a little bit about the integrities of life, history is a good start. It's very impersonal, and if it's well written, it tells you what happened to other people when they did the things we are doing. We will learn when they did it right, what happened that was good, and when they did it wrong, how punishment was inevitable. From these things, and from the study of comparative religion, you will come to understand the principles of integrities. You will come to understand the importance of the realization of universal brotherhood. you will come to the realization of the importance of accepting the normal responsibilities of life, not only with resolution, but with joy. That everything that is necessary is right, and that it is our privilege and opportunity to understand these right things and rejoice in them. We should not feel that a virtue is something we must sacrifice much for. A virtue is something that will help us not to sacrifice our entire life for nothing. So all these points and principles are part of the problem of teaching. Now, what shall we say about how you're going to recommend this to somebody? I think the only way to do it is to realize that in the world today there is an abundant literature by various religions of all times, by means of which the individual can get a brief summary or an elaborate discussion of the great integrities of life and the moral values which mankind has experienced through thousands of years of life. These various instructions will tell the person what good people have thought, what wise people have tried to live, and it will also help us to realize why today we honor and practically deify a handful of great dedicated spiritual persons who have become the foundations of civilization and of everything we hope for, everything we believe. We remember Jesus, who had no place to lay his head, but today is probably the most universally honored of human beings. We believe and recognize the great values that have come from dedication to principles. And we realize that these dedications are not dead, that we will never be so wise and scientific that we can get along without honesty. But all real science will lead us back to honesty. We must gradually recognize the use of knowledge. Knowledge is to prove to us the things we need to know, not that we hope, but that which we know. Therefore, science is to give us a new skill to understand the universe so that we may obey it and venerate it. Art gives us a new instrument by means of which we can picture forth our own inner interpretations of universal beauty. Music is indeed the music of the spheres that Pythagoras heard. It is the power to put all arts into a harmonic relationship. Music is the symbolism of universal harmony, and when it is variously distorted, it destroys its own consequences. Healing is the art of helping to restore the balance of the body, but is not possible to be completed without the unfoldment of the internal resources of the soul. Law is in order to keep us in a reasonable relationship with each other. Laws are most of them devised from ancient sources, and while these laws are naturally and properly kept, they are useful and significant. But when they are carefully intellectualized and integrity is taken out of them, they become a danger to our lives. All forms of knowledge are in themselves good, but the perversions of knowledge are now deemed necessary to success. And while we consider to do it this way and keep on making these perversions, we shall continue to fail, because the success is in the integrities and not in the breaches of integrity. So all the forms of knowledge that we know can help us to become aware of the one knowledge that is necessary, that we are creatures on a long journey through the caravanseries of this world, that we are wanderers in a strange desert of waiting, but that we are in a way wonderfully guided by the wisdom that has been given to us. We are in this world, but we are not destined to stay here. We are not here to become the source of great monuments on the physical plane of life. We are here in a great system of instruction, divinely inspired and divinely maintained. We are all at school together. Now we're in the kindergarten, or one of the lower grades, if we're having a little trouble. But someday we will become grade school teachers. Then we will become instructors in high schools. Then maybe we will be professors in colleges or universities. Those are the degrees of our headship. That is the degree of the esoteric order of things, that we shall rise to higher levels, but always to serve and to teach. But in all this teaching, everything depends upon one point, that all we can actually teach is to inspire the person to grow by virtue of his own integrities and his own potentials. The person can grow because the potential for growth is there. The inside is divine and it's going to come out. But in the meantime, these professors and so forth, the great world teachers and all the others, can only remind us that if we live the life, we shall know the doctrine. It will give us the courage to go and work on ourselves, and using their example as an inspiration, attempt to do that which they have done so faithfully. All of this is part of how to grow. And I think if we just become a little more discriminating and not too enthusiastic, we can observe for ourselves those types of instruction which are useful, normal, and proper, and at the same time can avoid involvement in something that we do not regard as proper. We are all searching, and we haven't the discretion to know always what is best. But if we always say to ourselves, what is kind, what is good, and what is inspired by the love of God and our fellow men, and is without exploitation and without ostentation, we won't be very far from the facts. So we hope each one of you, under this type of thinking, will be able to solve some of these problems for yourself. Thank you very much.